Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, David Olson will be with us speaking about the new theater work production, The Rug Merchants of Chaos. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Bill Shore. He is founder and executive director of the organization Share Our Strength, and he's the author of the new book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, Inspiration, Vision, and Purpose in the Quest to End Malaria. And he'll be speaking about the book on Thursday, the 24th of February at 6 in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is not only about the many efforts to wipe out malaria, but it's about the visionary people and the process that they go through in facing what seems like just one impossible task after another. How did you choose to focus on the work of the researcher Stephen Hoffman? I mean, researcher is far too small of a title, but who is this Stephen Hoffman and how did you choose him?
Well, I've always been interested in this issue of how do you solve problems that affect people who are so voiceless and vulnerable that there really are no markets for solving them. So that requires usually some extraordinarily entrepreneurial strategies and people who are able to imagine a future that may not yet exist but is within our grasp. And so as I started to ask people who fit that category, I got pointed in the direction of global health because there's a tremendous need around the world with poor kids, you know, and then particularly with malaria. 1 million kids a year almost die from malaria. It's a preventable and curable disease, but they're completely voiceless and vulnerable. Even if there were a malaria vaccine, they wouldn't be able to afford it. And so as I started to ask people who was doing work in this type of field trying to solve these problems where there are no markets, I got pointed first to malaria and then to Steve Hoffman, although it was interesting in that people almost in a ridiculing way talked about kind of that crazy thing Steve Hoffman was doing because his plan to develop a malaria vaccine was considered so far-fetched that a lot of respected researchers in the field, of which he had been one for many, many years, had begun to mock it.
What is malaria, and why is it so hard to fight?
Well, malaria is a remarkably complicated disease. It's been around for literally tens of thousands of years, and it's transmitted by mosquitoes. And the malaria parasite, once it gets into your bloodstream and then into your liver, begins to multiply at an almost unimaginable pace until there are literally billions and billions of malaria parasites within a very short while swimming through your blood and attaching themselves to your the walls of your veins and your arteries, and ultimately it kills you. But it's so complicated that it's a single-celled organism with 5,300 genes. Just to give you a sense of comparison, the HIV virus, which we've had such a hard time tackling, only has 13 genes. So with 5,300 genes, if any gene mutates, it can become resistant to medicines. And in all of the things we've tried over all of the centuries, the malaria parasite has always adapted and remained very strong. So it's a disease, as I say, that last year killed about 800,000 kids around the world. For 20 years before that, has killed about 1 million kids a year.
Now, kids are the most vulnerable, but other people get sick. What does the malaria kind of demographic look like? Who's getting it and where?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we used to have malaria in the United States in a big way. Our Center for Disease Control, which is headquartered in Atlanta now, was set up explicitly for the purpose of wiping malaria out of the United States, and that didn't happen until around 1950. So it used to be a problem here as well. Now it is a problem mostly in African countries and sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia. And as you said, everybody can get malaria if you're bit by the mosquito and the parasites transmitted to you. But if you have been bit and you've survived past the age of five, let's say you've had several bouts of malaria and they haven't killed you, then your immunities are strong enough that you can continue to have malaria as an adult. You'll be sick, you'll miss work, but it will not be fatal. For kids under five, their immune systems are just not strong enough to fight it, and so they often end up succumbing to the disease.
Now, the crazy complex genome of the malaria parasite actually has been mapped. Is that correct?
Yes, it has been mapped, and it was one of the first genomes to be mapped, almost as a consequence of the effort to map the human genome. And what Steve Hoffman had gone back to, it was a discovery made in 1968 that said that if you take the mosquito that's infected with the parasite, you radiate it to weaken the parasite, and then extract that parasite whole and inject that into you with a syringe, just like you would any vaccine, it will be strong enough to trigger your immune system, but not strong enough to kill you. So it would be a very effective vaccine. And when they tested it, not by injecting it, but by letting mosquitoes who had been radiated bite the arms of 14 volunteers, they found that it was 95% effective, more than double or triple any other vaccine candidate that had been tested. But of course, the doctors who discovered it in 1968, these were precursors of Steve Hoffman, said, of course, you can't deliver a vaccine by the bite of a mosquito. And so Steve has been working ever since to figure out how to replicate what we know is nature's own immunity.
And he's gone pretty far in doing that against all obstacles. I mean, it's a long and complicated story that you tell in the book, but maybe you could give us some of the highlights of the nature of his work and how far it's gotten.
Yeah, just the gist of it is when people talk about that crazy thing that Steve Hoffman's doing, what they envision is a room full of people in white lab coats bent over tables dissecting mosquito salivary glands to extract these parasites and use them to make vaccines. And if you can imagine the precision handwork required to dissect mosquitoes' salivary glands, you're talking obviously about very minute work. So when you go to Steve Hoffman's lab, as I did, what you find is, in fact, a room full of people bent over tables dissecting mosquito salivary glands. And what he had decided, although it was, extraordinarily impractical to manufacture a vaccine this way, he believed that maybe impractical is better than a million kids a year dying from malaria. So he wasn't daunted by the impractical nature of it. And I think, one of the things I learned from Steve is that, many times when we say something's not possible, we kind of use that as a shorthand. We don't mean it in a literal sense. What we mean is it's very expensive. It's very time-consuming. It'd be very difficult to deliver. But that's different from it's not possible. And, in fact, the first thing he told me on the first day I met him was that the solution to a malaria vaccine was not based on scientific discovery. It was based on biotech engineering, which is to say we know a solution. We just have to find a way to manufacture it, replicate it, get it to scale and sustain it. And that, of course, is true. And what attracted me to this, because my work has been in the hunger field for the last 25 years, what attracted me to this is I found that to be true of so many other social issues which we are confronted with, whether they happen to be education or health care or job creation or hunger. We often have solutions, and we know what they are. They're just expensive and difficult to deliver and all the rest, but that doesn't mean we don't know what the solutions are.
And as you talk about it, the just crazy precision of extracting saliva from mosquitoes' salivary glands tends to be the easy part of this whole thing. Why is it? What was the hard part for Steve Hoffman?
Well, that's right, because what you have to do is not only extract these parasites, but then you need to do it in a way that is pure and sterile, and where they can be kept shelf stable. And ultimately delivered into the arms of kids in Africa thousands of miles away at different temperatures and climates and so forth. So that's really been the hard part, is figuring out how to deliver the vaccine. What has driven Steve Hoffman to such great lengths, and there are lots of other, impressive figures in this field as well, but what has driven him to such great lengths is knowing that there is an immunogen, in other words, that there is a substance that would trigger your immune system and that could save the lives of all these kids. It's just a question of how do we actually get it into the people who need it the most.
So what is the status of the vaccine at this point?
Well, he is in the first stage of clinical trials right now. There's a competitor vaccine developed by a large pharmaceutical, GlaxoSmithKline, which is in the third phase of clinical trials. So most observers believe that it will be the first vaccine to market, but it's never been more than about 50 or 60% effective. So people are waiting to see whether Steve Hoffman's vaccine, even though it will come later, will be better if it indeed offers the promise of protection of 90%. And in the first phase of the first phase of clinical trials, the trials did not go as well as he wanted. That didn't have a high level of protection. So now he's going back and he's tweaked the trial a little bit, and they'll actually be injecting people within the next 6 months with a modified vaccine.
There's a very big question in your book, which is the role of the so-called free market versus the role of government support in making things like this happen. So you wrote, for example, that if a big pharmaceutical company were to announce that they were working on a malaria vaccine, which this company is that you talk about, but their stock price would plummet because no affluent people can buy a malaria vaccine. So how do you think about the proper role of public, for-profit, non-profit government agents in the movement for not only the malaria vaccine, but effective public health care in general, especially for poor people, poor nations?
Yeah, you really put your finger on the key question, and that's why I was so interested in this kind of concoction of entrepreneurial strategies that have been developed to achieve this, because the concern is, even with an effective vaccine, kids in Africa and their families are not going to be able to afford it. And so how do you get around that? So for example, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is doing quite a bit of work now, both to develop vaccines and to create, in effect, markets or substitutes for markets for them. So they've created something called an advanced market commitment. And the idea is to get nations around the world to agree that, not to invest in a vaccine necessarily, but to agree that if a vaccine is successful, then they will commit to buy $X hundred million worth and distribute it in Africa or in Asia. That way, at least the manufacturers and the developers of the vaccine know that, you know, should all of their hard work come to fruition, there will at least be a customer for what they're doing. So this idea of advanced market commitments with the Gates Foundation, former President Bill Clinton's foundation, has been very active in pursuing. It's changed the economics of this to some degree, not all of the way, but you know, that's the key, is how do you kind of create some substitutes for the market mechanisms that, you know, if you developed a drug like Viagra, if you developed a drug for male pattern baldness, or developed a drug for diabetes, there'd be an immediate, you know, profitable, lucrative market for it. But that's not going to be the case with some of these neglected diseases like malaria.
Well, and that's another just big problem that needs to be talked about, which is that, as you wrote in the book, 90% of health spending goes toward 10% of the world's population and 10% of the problems, which, to be frank, are much more serious than male pattern baldness. Why is it set up like this? Is it just simply as simple as a matter of wealth and poverty?
It really is a matter of wealth and poverty and all of the inequities that flow from that. And I think, again, to me, what makes this issue so difficult to solve and so poignant in so many ways is that, you know, the victims of it are really the most voiceless of all. They're politically and economically marginalized. They don't have a lobbyist. They don't have representatives. They're not at the table when decisions about huge allocations of funding are being made. This is true of, you know, many constituencies within the United States as well, because we've got a remarkable level of poverty here now, and with the after effects of the recession and unemployment and so forth. But I think the real challenge is, how do you solve problems that affect people who are really just, they don't have the economic or the political power?
There's also a very interesting question that you discuss in the book, namely whether dealing with public health, especially, again, in underfunded places like Africa, is best done, you use the terms vertical and horizontal, which are kind of, in some ways, business terms, but vertically taking on individual diseases like malaria, like polio, and so on, or horizontally, which means fostering better public health services on a local level. Show us this problem. What does it look like to you?
Yeah, and the truth is that you probably have to do both, but the best example of this has probably been this effort over the last 30 or 40 years to eradicate polio from the globe. You know, we've only done that with one disease in human history. That's smallpox, and it exists only in a test tube in a laboratory locked up somewhere. We finally eradicated it. And with polio, we've come very, very close to eradicating polio. But what many of the public health experts realize, and I think what the Gates Foundation realized, because they'd come late to the party, but since they got there, they'd been very, very aggressive and generous in supporting efforts to end polio, is that you can't do that in the absence of a public health infrastructure. You've also got to have clean water, and you've got to have medical and clinical facilities that people in villages can go visit, and there's just a whole range of complications to trying to deliver health care for one specific disease as opposed to, you know, a real public health infrastructure that keeps the rest of the person's body healthy as well. So there have been some, you know, important learnings in this, and I think, you know, polio is a good example. A lot of those active in the fight kind of went back to the drawing board and said, okay, we'll have to invest in not just a polio vaccine and not just in distribution of it, but in building the surrounding public health infrastructure as well.
I was thinking about the tragedy, and I mean, you've seen this firsthand. You start the book talking about a very wonderful teenage girl whom you met when you were traveling in Africa, and then it turned out that she died of malaria, and it was one of the things that brought the whole question home to you of why this was important, just the incredible waste of human lives to this ugly and awful disease. So we have that in one hand. On the other hand, we have a world which is populating itself so very rapidly, and if it hasn't already, it's exceeding its ability to sustain the people on it. In other words, we are overpopulating the planet in relation to our food resources in the sea and on the land and so on. How do you think of those things together?
Boy, it's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that really surprised me is that most of the people who were in the middle of the fight kind of don't think about those things together. So the scientist working on the malaria vaccine focuses on the vaccine, and another scientist working on medicine focuses on medicine. And somebody who cares about sustainability and kind of the environmental and economic issues surrounding it focuses on those. And you know, absent both, you know, really compelling national and international global leadership, all of those strings don't get pulled together like they need to be, because you're right. I mean, it's almost a variation of what we were talking about a moment ago with polio and a public health structure. You have to look at the larger ecosystem and ensure that that's sound as well. So, I mean, these are very complex challenges, particularly when they're affecting, you know, tens of millions of people. Not only do a million kids die from malaria, but 300 to 500 million people get infected by it. So you're dealing with a set of issues across, you know, national boundaries, across all kinds of different geographies and economies, and it makes it very complex.
We're talking to Bill Shore. He is the author of the new book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, Inspiration, Vision, and Purpose in the Quest to End Malaria. Let's talk for a moment about your organization, Share Our Strength. It's a nonprofit which is devoted to ending childhood hunger. You're doing a campaign that kicks off this coming weekend called No Kid Hungry. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I think this is very much related to what we were talking about, because we've been focusing on hunger in America for the last 25 years, and in the last five in particular, on why kids in America are hungry. And one of the things that is probably obvious to most people is, in America, unlike other parts of the world, we don't have hunger because of drought or famine or war. We don't have hunger because of lack of food or even because of lack of food or nutrition programs. The reason kids are hungry is that they lack access to those programs. So we've now got 48 million Americans living below the poverty line. We've got 44 million Americans on food stamps, now called the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. And of those 44 million on SNAP food stamps, fully half of those are children for the first time in the history of this country. So we've got this, you know, very significant issue in America of kids being hungry. But the irony is, and the reason that this is so unnecessary and such a curable and solvable problem is, you know, for 25 years we've also had bipartisan support for very effective programs that almost everybody agrees works. School breakfast programs, school lunch, summer feeding, the SNAP food stamp program. And so when you look at why there's still hunger, you realize that large numbers of kids are not participating. So in New Mexico, for example, 60% of the eligible kids get school breakfast, but that should be 100%. And then, and in the summertime, there's less than 35% of kids in New Mexico participated in summer feeding. And these are programs, again, that are already authorized and appropriated funds set aside at the federal level to come into a state and support these kids. But again, the challenge is these kids don't have representatives, they don't have lobbyists, they don't have a voice. And so we've tried to provide that. And what we've been doing is going state by state, starting in Maryland, then in Colorado, Arkansas, now New Mexico. We work with local partners. The New Mexico Collaboration to End Hunger is a coalition of about 80 partners from the private and public and nonprofit sector that we'll be working with. And we identify what are the barriers to these kids being part of these programs, because we know that if these kids get enrolled in these programs, they'll work, they'll be healthy, they'll have nutritious meals, they'll do better in school. It's just a win-win for everybody.
Beyond giving hungry kids food through government programs, I mean, you have basically a big pink elephant sitting in the middle of the coffee table, which is that we in the United States are almost at a third world level of inequality of wealth and income. So, and we don't have a sufficient safety net, or even the safety net you're talking about isn't sufficiently used, but really one would like people to be able to feed their own families rather than have to get handouts from somewhere. Are you doing things to address that problem?
Oh, we're trying. We're very cognizant of the fact that hunger is a symptom of a much deeper issue, which is poverty, and that we have an economy that leaves a lot of Americans living below the poverty line. One of the really kind of vexing aspects of this issue is that even during President Bill Clinton's presidency, when the economy was considered to be booming, we had 36 million Americans living below the poverty line. So even at a time when, as a nation, with the technology boom and everything else, that we were doing what we thought was, you know, our best economically, we were leaving an entire large segment of our population behind. One of the challenges here, I think, is that really smart Democrats and really smart Republicans and really smart liberals and really smart conservatives disagree on what you do to actually end poverty. How do you create economic opportunity? Clearly, you have to invest in education. Clearly, you have to invest in job creation. That seemed to be, you know, for our organization, for Share Our Strength, those are all things we would support. But when we looked at where can we actually move the needle in a triage decision that you would make if you were a healthcare worker, and thinking about something that the writer Jonathan Kozol once said, which was pick battles important enough to matter but small enough to win. We thought at least as the first thing we could do is kind of stabilize these kids who were being so damaged and impaired nutritionally, and get them enrolled in these programs. So it's just a first step to your question. I think it's a great question. I think what we're doing is an important first step, but it's only a first step to what really has to happen in America so that people have economic opportunity and don't need this kind of assistance in the first place.
Are the different foods that are offered in the programs that you're supporting, the breakfast and lunch programs and so on, are they really good, delicious, and nutritious foods? Are they not junk foods?
Well, it's getting better and better. You know, I'd say this was an area that was, school meals was an area, you know, 15 years ago that was almost totally neglected, and nobody was really paying close attention to what was being served and what the kids were eating. That's begun to change. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, has had a major initiative on this. We've worked with lots of chefs and restaurateurs who have become very involved in their own school food service delivery programs. I would hope that would be something that we'll end up doing in New Mexico as well. It's been true in just about every state we've worked, where some of the chefs and others who have been very active, not just on the issue of hunger, but on the issue of nutrition and healthy eating, sustainable eating, farm-to-table, farm-to-school types of movements, have become involved in this and have really, to some degree, transformed the way meals are being prepared in schools. In most schools today, they don't even have kitchens. You know, they have hot boxes that reheat packaged meals. But that's starting to change as well. And so that's hopefully something that we'll be able to bring to this No Kid Hungry campaign in New Mexico.
You write about moral imagination. That's a very important part of this book. Moral imagination, entrepreneurship, leadership. And there's this great analogy about the researcher Stephen Hoffman being like one of those I think floor cleaning robots who, when he walks into a wall, he just turns into the other way and keeps going, walks into another wall, never gets hurt, just keeps going until the job is done. And it's a wonderful analogy. And I was wondering, what does all this mean for ordinary people of ordinary abilities who don't have ambitions of that magnitude, but still find the desire to do something productive and be of service?
Well, one of the things that we've learned over, you know, a quarter century now of doing this work at Share Our Strength, and it's derivative from the name of the organization, is that literally everybody has a strength to share. Everybody has something to give back. So chefs can cook and teach nutrition, and engineers and architects can help people figure out how to build institutions, and you know, writers can write stories that can be sold and funds used to support anti-poverty efforts. We've done all of that type of work at Share Our Strength, and we've found so many ways in which, you know, people have a strength to share. And with the issue of hunger in particular, this is not rocket science. There is a role for everybody, whether it's volunteering at a soup kitchen or a food bank or contributing or donating. But I also think that, you know, most people have ideas of ways that they would do things differently. Sometimes they don't necessarily have the courage to put those ideas forth. They seem unrealistic. They seem unreasonable. They've never been tried before. To me, that's, you know, that's what I call kind of the visionary's dilemma, which is the, you know, the larger and bolder and more ambitious your vision is, the more people are going to at first resist it and mock it and find ways to tear it down. But this ability to, you know, imagine a future that doesn't exist but is within our grasp, and to stay faithful to that, you know, adapting as you go, not necessarily being dogmatic, but being, you know, faithful to this vision that others may not have seen yet, ultimately changes the world. There's lots of different examples of people who have been successful at that, but you just have to stick with it.
Bill Shore is author of the new book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, Inspiration, Vision, and Purpose in the Quest to End Malaria. And he's the founder and executive director of the organization Share Our Strength, which can be found on the web at strength.org. And he will be speaking Thursday, the 24th of February at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And he will also be talking about the No Kid Hungry campaign here in New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to welcome back to the program David Olson. He is the artistic director of Theater Work, and Theater Work is presenting The Rug Merchants of Chaos, a play by Ronald Ribman, opening this Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Now, Theater Work, a wonderful theater company here in Santa Fe, is doing this play that is set in the mid-1980s, and it's basically, it's almost people stranded on a desert island. They're people on a ship, two couples escaping from a crime. Set up the story for us.
Well, they definitely are trying to escape. We come in on them after they've been bouncing from one failed enterprise that's just going to make them a pile of money after the other. And the latest one was investing in a bunch of cheap carpets and trying to sell them cheaply to people, and finally no one would buy them. The things would fall apart. There's one moment they describe that one of them has butterfly patterns, and when at the first foot swipe, the wings and antenna disappear. So not such good rugs.
Not so good.
And so they have a warehouse full of these things, and they decide that the best way out might be just to sort of burn the carpets to offload the burden of those carpets and head out for something else. Well, unfortunately, not just the carpets burn. We're given to believe that the building, the warehouse, catches fire. We don't know how far that fire has gone, but in any case, off they go. They're in, of all places, Cape Town, South Africa, and the only boat, or what seems to be a boat, floating thing that's leaving the harbor is what they think is a freighter. Turns out to be a garbage scow. In other words, a rusty hulk that's heading out just to dump the garbage. And on it they get. They've paid a great amount of money to get out of town. We can hear the sirens and see the flames in the distance. And there they are once again, another failed business. We come to, though, understand these people really well, I think.
Indeed. Two couples one couple is basically just a born businessman and a schemer who wants to make a bunch of money and always has a great vision and may not be so practical or realistic or good on the follow-through.
Not at all good on the follow-through. He can convince anyone, apparently, of anything. That's his gift. Gift of gab. As you say, he can get very enthusiastic. We see him a few times in the play getting very enthusiastic about new schemes and possibilities. And we come to understand that, yeah, if you didn't know him very well, you could think, oh, listen to this guy. He's really got it going. He's a businessman. He's an entrepreneur. He's all those things. And he's deeply in love with his wife, which is really interesting to watch, I think, too. And that sort of starts to mitigate how we understand this guy, who on his own, you might think, what a con artist.
And she's very much in love with him. And
very
she's a
much.
Southern belle who, no matter how bad things get, looks perfectly put together, and her hair and her nails and her little high-heeled shoes and her shorts are just never a stitch out of place.
Every time she looks in her first appearance, which happens soon after we hear sirens and see flames in the background, first comes the other woman onto the boat, carrying everything she could grab haphazardly, willy-nilly from her house. None of it makes any sense whatsoever, but there she is, layers of clothing. And then comes this other woman,
the southern woman
Annie, looking as though she were invited for the weekend onto the Kennedy's yacht,
right?
And somehow, we don't know how, they only had minutes to get it together, but somehow we discover in the course of the play, which basically covers about a 24-hour period, that she had everything she needed for a cruise. And we don't know how, we decided that she must have had it packed at all times,
right,
ready to go.
Which is something that many of us have thought of doing, but few have ever actually
right.
done. Now, the other couple somehow got involved with these two first people who we've just been talking about. They met at a rest stop somewhere, at a taco stand, got talking and got sort of drawn into the idea of getting rich quick and doing these enterprises. And they are, at least the wife, well, both of them, more sort of college-educated people who followed along at their own peril for mm-hmm. years and years. And the wife, Sheila, has to be one of the most annoying people in the history of theater. Characters, I mean.
She seems to be. I, of course, have been working with Sheila for many weeks, so I've come to sort of like her.
Really?
But, oh,
I wanted
do.
To throw tomatoes at her. I was in the rehearsal last night.
Well, I think that's a... I understand why. She's determined to see the worst. She's determined to see the bad. In things. But I think there is a moment in the play, I don't necessarily want to hand it over.
Give it away,
I think people need to hear it in her voice. And in the midst of all of this chaos, we could talk about what chaos is in the play too. There's a couple of chaoses there. But there's a moment in which she expresses her response to her husband's saying to her that perhaps his suffering, he's a Vietnam veteran who was responsible for a little platoon of men and had to drag them out of the jungle himself and that sort of thing. Some of them didn't come out. And he seems to say to her that his suffering or what he experienced was somehow more grave, more complex than what she experiences. And she responds, I think, very poignantly to that. And when I heard that out loud, of course, I had read the play many, many times before starting and made a plan and knew where I was going. But when I heard it aloud the first time, something opened inside me. And I think the play is like that. It's filled with all kinds of layers and levels, and things come bursting through all of a sudden, as can happen when you're with a person. You know, they're grumbling and grousing, and then they say something that takes you to a moment that you haven't seen but that begins to explain them to you, and your attitude may soften, or at least you are willing to listen further. And I think that character is like that's beautifully played,
very, very well played
by Kat Sawyer, a very accomplished actor who really has devoted herself to getting inside Kat and not mitigating those qualities that you're talking about. You might want to throw a tomato at.
Yeah, you want to throw her overboard.
It's hard. It's hard to do that in a way for an actor to not present himself or herself as likable.
Really?
I think so.
I've always wondered what it would be like to play a villain. Not that I'm an actor, because I'm not, but if you have the role of the person that everybody's going to hate.
Yeah. Well, a villain is one thing, because I think a villain is all the role of a villain is all set up so that we appreciate, we understand that right from the beginning, we go with it. We know we're meant to be irritated or angered or disturbed by that character. But in the case of Sheila Finkelberg, Sheila doesn't know that about herself at all. In fact, Sheila on the inside is extremely vulnerable and open to being susceptible to the things around her. And so the actor in this case has to play both. She has to not arm herself internally and have this armor that she's trying to erect, I would say not very successfully, on the outside to protect herself. In fact, she's even carrying stuff that's meant to protect her. She even insists on wearing a great big old sealskin coat in 110-degree weather on this miserable, stinky garbage scow of a boat. Because why? Not because she's vain, but because she feels that it will offer her some protection and some way through all of this. It has a value, she says, and she doesn't just mean monetary. She means that in some ways it gives her a kind of presence and a kind of, you know, status, which is important to her. She keeps telling us that she's a Bennington graduate.
Right. Yeah, and it's the questions of what status means and what education means, and really what anything means when you're in a dire situation where nobody cares about those things and where other values, like knowing how to fix a motor,
right,
or knowing how to survive in various ways, come to the fore.
Yes, knowing when you're out in the middle of the ocean and you have no way out of there, no way forward, and can't go back, what do you do? I mean, it reflects, doesn't it, back onto other stories and pieces of literature and so on, where people are caught on water, you know, or have to cross over water into a new life. So this particular playwright knows both the crazy chaos that, you know, Lucy and Desi and Fred and Ethel knew. And he also clearly knows, and has studied the chaos of the Greeks, which is this other chaos where one could fall into emptiness, fall into nothing.
Right. So that chaos, explain more about that in what chaos means in the Greek sense.
Well, in the Greek sense, it's that notion that the surrounding me somehow is the entirely other, and that everything I have or have pretended to be or know makes no difference if I enter it. So it's not a place of torture or a place of horror. Torture and horror would give me something to chew on, something to resist, something to suffer. But chaos in the Greek sense, as Ribman presents it, is, as I say, this place where nothing that I carry with me would make a difference. And so it's to be annihilated. In other words, to disappear. So that chaos, you know, I said in the program, but I quoted what I imagined an audience member saying, hey, I thought this was supposed to be a comedy. Well, it is. It is a comedy. There are great comedians, if you think of the great comedians, who could portray both the foolishness and the goofiness and the absurdity of the things that can happen to us And then somewhere through that, you look at them or you see them on the screen or even on the little screen. There were characters that, you know, that I've seen even on television who in certain series or comedic series that actually at times break open and you see them struggling. And I'm very drawn, of course, to that, those levels of performing, because that's what I do.
Right.
I work in the theater, and we're interested in not presenting stereotypes and you know, things that are already answered before anybody sits down, but presenting experiences that are in some way transformative, that the audience person takes a little trip with us for a couple of hours. I don't just mean that figuratively. I mean, actually, you know, it starts at 7:30, and by 9:30, we've listened to and seen and felt and remembered a lot. I hope that's what theater, I think, is still for. It's different from TV, of course, or film, because it's live.
Right. And you have it set up. We're talking, by the way, to David Olson of Theater Work about the play The Rug Merchants of Chaos, which is opening this Friday. And it's at the James A. Little Theater. And like some of the other plays that you've done there, you have it set up where the audience is sitting on the stage in a kind of, do you call them bleachers?
Risers.
Risers that you've set up.
It's
and
very
so it's
similar.
Very intimate.
Yes, it's very intimate. We felt that this play really required that. Again, a wonderful challenge to the actors to be utterly visible, because you can even see their pupils dilate. You can see.
Are your actors so good that they can make their pupils dilate?
I don't think it's that they can make them do it. I think they do know, however, how to enter into a moment so intensely that you can see it. I mean, when I sit there watching, I'm often amazed. I can see a tear form in Jack Sherman's eye long before the character admits to what he's angry about or hasn't said before but needs somehow now to say. So long before he says it, I can see a tear appearing in the corner of an eye. And then a few seconds, maybe some many seconds later, out comes the line and out comes the tear. And it's nothing he's calculating. It's something, you know, he's been with theater work since he was 19. He's, you know, over 50 now. He works and works and works at being an actor.
So, amazing.
You know, when the audience arrives at the theater, they may not realize that the actors have been there already for an hour. And they're not sitting, or at least that, and they're not sitting backstage kind of having a cigarette and chatting and, you know, texting. They come in and they have a full warm-up period, which is really not just exercises or something. They do it independently all at once in the same room, out in the hall, actually. But they are actually warming up. It's a simple way of saying it, voice, body, so on. But also warming up those internal spaces, opening,
yeah.
opening. So that by the time the lights go up on Act One, they're fully there. They don't just start getting there when they walk onto the stage. They're there already. And that's just good acting process. I mean, that's not anything mysterious, or I wouldn't hope not unique to theater work, but it's certainly a value that we have at theater work, that actors are very ready when the play begins.
There is in this play not only the theme of chaos, but also the theme of faith,
yeah,
against all odds. And
wow,
it's very interesting to see these two, especially the two female characters, the men too, but Sheila, the realist, pessimist complainer, against Annie, who we might think is not that bright, but has faith and really far more practicality when you look at it, when you look at it realistically, than her college-educated counterpart.
Far, far more. She's more what we call these days, or used to call, grounded, by which I mean she literally is in the world. She's in the moment. You see her, one of the first things she does when she gets into this hideous so-called lounge, which is really has been a storeroom filled with trash furniture that this captain, in an effort to, you know, charge these people a lot of money to get out of town, has just pushed this crap aside, this stuff aside.
And that's their cabin
and
that they paid their good money
for. Cabin
that
they paid $8,000 for. And so one of the first things she does, she looks around, she sees what it is, but she's carrying a little Picasso print, and she sees a spot up on top of this filthy refrigerator, and she places very carefully her little Picasso print up there. Not in an effort to show off or anything, but in an effort to make things look a little better. And it's quite charming. And when I say charming, I mean as strongly as you can use that word. Eventually, I think she's the character that one would wish you had with you in a bad situation, because she looks for the possible. She's always saying, well, this isn't so bad, you know, and she's sitting on this steaming, you know, some would think even sort of a cooking deck at the beginning of Act Two, and she's putting on suntan lotion. She's got a little sunning outfit on, her little sunglasses, and there's nothing to read on this ship except old and girly magazines, so she's discovered for herself that there actually are articles in these magazines. I looked at one, and there is pretty interesting article in one of them, if you can, you know, get yourself quickly past the pictures. So, you know, it's very interesting, I think, that Ribman has put this kind of what I would call, quoting Paul Tillich, courage to be in the character of Annie, who seems shallow at first. And what we would normally call shallow, I would say not shallow at all, actually. But you have to watch and watch and watch to realize why not.
Right.
How that surface belies the interior.
It sort of reminded me of something that I used to see. There were women who called themselves feminists and made a lot of noise. And then there were women who didn't do any of the things that feminists were supposed to do. So they looked very girly.
Yeah.
But they were strong and got just what they wanted and had a kind of fearlessness and perhaps faith also. Mm-hmm. And when I noticed that contrast way back when I was in my 20s, I kind of took it to heart and said, okay, surfaces don't tell you anything. It's what people do.
I was just thinking that in the play, Annie embodies the capacity for courage. She even speaks to it at one point. But courage, I think, has to do with hope, always. And, again, this theologian, philosopher Tillich, in The Courage to Be, talks about courage being the hope that comes after hope is lost. And I think that character, and I think Ribman, let's talk about the playwright, I think the playwright must know something very deeply about that. I think he does, because I think he's written a play that, while it touches on the goofy stereotypes of television and film and so on, actually pushes way past that, but not all at once and not finally, but it keeps pushing past it. I mean, every once, you know, in the midst of all the goofiness and silliness of Sheila and her whining and so on. In the midst of that, right in the middle of it, we suddenly hear something that is a way through. If she could only hear it,
right.
You know.
The play is called The Rug Merchants of Chaos, and it opens this Friday, the 18th of February at 7:30, and runs this weekend and next weekend. So this weekend it's Friday and Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, and then the following weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30, and Sunday at 2, James A. Little Theater. For tickets, you can call 471-1799. You can email mail@theaterwork.org or just go to the website theaterwork.org. David Olson is the Artistic Director of Theater Work. Thank you so much for being with us
on
Radio
you.
Cafe.
I really appreciate your interest in theater. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.